But I do see you on here, Stephen, so I'm going to pivot and welcome you tonight to the call. We're so glad.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
Yeah, we're glad to have you a part of the second part of our Call to Calm series, which is, in general, it's looking at how we can bring peace and civility into the political season, which is very important and needed right now, especially given this political climate. So let me just do a quick introduction, Stephen, then I'll turn it over to you.
Okay.
Stephen's just been such a great friend to the Peace Alliance over the years and partner. He is the founder and CEO of the Shift Network, which offers virtual summits, online courses and trainings. As a visionary political strategist, his new book, Sacred America, Sacred World, shows how we can discover higher transpartisan solutions in areas from peacebuilding to campaign finance reform, from microfinance to the path to a zero carbon economy, and calls us into sacred citizenship by offering inspiring solutions and innovative bridge building examples that are ultimately based in oneness rather than our separation. And it's been my great pleasure to have formed both a partnership and a friendship with you, Stephen, over these years. It's been so encouraging to have all of you and the Shift Network's support, and we're all looking forward to this conversation tonight. So with that, Stephen, I'll just hand it over to you. And, you know, I'd love for you to start by sharing anything you'd like, of course, in this theme. And we have some questions, and we'll have Q&A with folks as we finish. But in particular, we'd love to hear about your new book. What's the main thrust of it? And we'd love to hear what inspired you to write it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'll start with where I am. I just completed an event at the Meditation Museum in Washington, D.C. with Sister Jenna, some amazing music. Marianne Williamson spoke via live cast. And we really had a room full of 80 or 90 people who lifted our hearts and souls to be really unifying with the highest part of ourselves, and then talking about how do we bring that into our political situation to be healers, to be catalysts for the birth of a new possibility. And it's just been so deeply rewarding to be in this space. And you know, we have talked about the hard things. We've talked about the racial divides and the heartbreak in America, and it's important that we do that and that we take our role as peace builders seriously now, because these are the times that we've trained for. These are the times that we have practiced for, to be the people who hold the whole when the parts are getting more and more separated and more antagonistic and often violent. We have divides of all sorts now that have been exaggerating, from the primary political divide of Democrats and Republicans to the class divides, 99% versus the 1%, from racial divides, or African Americans and police officers across a polarity there, and so much of the racial wounds that have not healed. So, and not to mention, the West versus Islam, which is one of the most prominent and problematic ones. So the forces of separation are strong right now, and the pain from that is very palpable. And so I first want to speak into and honor the depth of our situation and the pain, the very real pain that many of us are feeling right now at the level in which we're feeling really torn apart. And In that heartbreak, in that tumult of change, it's like there is an opportunity for us now to find this higher ground and to fulfill a deeper mission. And that's really the source out of which I wrote the book, Sacred America, Sacred World. It was written out of a recognition that it is time for us to upgrade to a new level of consciousness and a new operating system for our society, one that is based in a sacred ground of being. You know, Native Americans often talk about this, that the sacred is in all of creation, that all of creation is sacred, and that all of us, whatever religious tradition we come from or spiritual tradition or even scientific tradition, there's something that we hold as precious, as sacred, whether it's our family or truth or a religion, that we hold something with reverence in our heart and deep respect and honor and beauty. And that is, I believe, how we have to start really engaging our country. because our country is something that's been entrusted to us. It's not just a place that we've been born into and we happen to kind of make do. It's like I believe that we choose to incarnate here and that we are consciously participating in the upliftment of the whole. So now is really a time in which that can happen in a more dramatic way, because it is these moments where there is great strife, that there is an opening for the emergence of the new. But it's what it's going to take is peace builders who are able to transcend the polarization in our own hearts and go beyond the political divides and the class divides and the racial divides and find that higher ground that unites us as fellow human beings, as people who are committed and care about birthing a better world. And I think it's particularly important right now that we don't think of peace builders as just kind of like another sector of society, but really like the people who are committing to hold that whole and to find alliances and build bridges even in unlikely places, whether that means reaching out and at this point really building bridges with local police forces and being somebody who is a friend, an ally there, or reaching out to and perhaps and into African American communities. If we haven't done that work before, it's time to say, how can I be taking a responsibility for being part of the solution? Or if it's political divides, I'm personally feeling called to go to the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. I don't have tickets in, but I want to go there to be part of really creating a wave of peace and more understanding and more friendship rather than protests and anger. It's really saying we need to have more of the force that's uniting us rather than just the forces that are separating. And I'm going to go from there to the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and then we're going to have a large online summit called the American Citizen Summit, where we really remember our higher unity and remember the whole that we're part of. So circling back to the book, it's like the book is really born of a deep desire I have for the world to become whole and peaceful and healthy and prosperous. And in order for us to do that right now, one of the most important areas that we need to shift is the American political culture, because it's become so divisive and so polarized, and America is really broken in some really fundamental ways. And so that requires a healing impulse and a unifying impulse. And so in the book, I talk about how we can find that by first honoring and deepening into the sacred roots and intentions of our country. E Pluribus Unum is a mission more than a motto. It's to lead towards larger wholes, to find the unity within diversity, to demonstrate what's possible as we come together rather than we're just separate. And so we find this in the deeper roots of who we are, but we also find an expression and a vision of what is possible that we're moving towards, that we find paint a picture of the America that can be born that is inclusive, that there's space for the full range of us, that it's not just a few people, but really all people see a way that we can thrive together and that we can heal the deep wounds and we can do the shadow work that we haven't done, which is part of what's erupting right now, is we have a lot of shadow work that we haven't done as a country. But to do that without judgment, to do it in a sacred spirit of like loving even the parts of us that have been broken and wounded and dysfunctional and out of integrity, that is what we need to restore into the wholeness. So I think that's ultimately the task of peace builders. And ultimately, the core of America is to create, I believe that we are designed literally to eventually become some of the greatest peace builders in the world, and that's at the core of who we are, E Pluribus Unum, to create a more perfect union. And I think that does lead us beyond the divisions into the global reunification. Anyway, so that was a long riff. I'll let you jump in then.
No, that's great. That's great. I love that. E Pluribus Unum is a mission more than a motto, and it's a mighty mission too. And so I love that you're doing this work and writing this book and engaging in this. And I know many folks on the call equally feel that calling. So it's great to be in this dialogue together. Thanks for that. You know, one of the things going with this theme that we have of this call series of Call to Calm, Stephen, would love for you to talk a bit about any thoughts that you might have on how, you know, this is a big topic for folks, especially right now during the election, and it feeds into how do we hold this sacred activism. So looking at how can we disagree around politics or political ideas, but still be respectful and not malign each other personally. You know, many folks have friends, family, colleagues who disagree on some of these issues, and it can be very challenging to navigate these conversations. I'm not just saying this because I was just in Texas visiting my family who disagree with my politics. But just any tips or pointers you have, because it's a big time, you know. There's a lot of divisiveness right now.
Well, I think it's important that we go to the depths, first of all, within ourselves and look at where are we prejudiced and where do we cast people out of our own heart. Because when people can pick that up, they're going to react badly. If people don't feel seen, respected, and honored, then there's going to be a rupture in the relationship. And so if we really want to be peace builders, we have to go into those areas where we are polarized and where we are judgmental and where we are angry, and do some shadow work of our own of like, what is it that we are rejecting in ourselves? And so I'll give an example for me. Sarah Palin in 2008, when she became the vice presidential nominee, I really could not stand watching her on TV. I mean, she drove me crazy. I was like nails on a chalkboard listening to her voice. I hadn't experienced hate for some time, and I really felt some real hatred towards her. But instead of just dwelling in that, I took it on as a practice. I said, well, how can I transform this? And so I read both of her books and really went into understanding who she was, how she grew up, and started to have more empathy. And I could see the frontier psychology and go kill a moose for dinner kind of, you know, and how that shapes a culture and a consciousness. And there are things that she did that I really found admirable, like bringing in a child even though the child had Down syndrome. And I didn't become more conservative in reading the book, but what I did is humanized her and opened to really understanding her life journey and seeing how she could have the values and the positions and the understanding of the world that she did. And so I kind of met her in her own turf. And at the end of that, I ended up having a dream that was quite a simple dream, but I kind of went into a house and she was there and sitting, and we talked a little bit and we hugged. And it was a very sweet hug, and so I'd gone from really hating her to actually hugging her in my dream. And then I went beyond that and actually wrote an article about this for Huffington Post called Dissolving the Palin Prejudice. And what was beautiful, first of all, my progressive friends were a bit mortified that I had even done this, but on the conservative side, there was a lot of people who wrote me fan mail, and they told me how much they had felt like seen and honored and respected by that. And it was a healing for them to read that, and it was a healing for me to write it. So I think that when we're talking about having a healing influence or influence of call to calm, or holding a kind of a third position right now for the collective, which is a peacemaking position, we have to first do some excavation into the places of polarization in our own hearts. It doesn't mean we have to stop being discerning. We might I think probably a lot of peace builders are particularly troubled by Donald Trump right now. And I'm not saying to drop whatever discernments you have there about whether he's really the right next president for the country, but rather to sort of, it's important with political leaders that we feel through the surface expression to something deeper, the intrinsic divinity at their core, the intrinsic humanity, just the dignity that we have to respect people as fellow humans on this planet. And so that takes some work oftentimes, because politics is very charged and it's easy to demonize and polarize and to have unexamined assumptions. And so I think of this as political cross-training. So even if I'm a strong progressive, it behooves me to spend time learning from conservatives or understanding the world from their perspective, because A, it makes me a better peace builder, and B, it also leads to better solutions. And so when we have like that spirit of more inclusivity, we can hold deeper solutions. And I think this is particularly important that we take this kind of third position right now, which is to hold the space for the healing of these divides. I think that as peace builders, it's not just about arguing from one side, although there is a role for that, and I don't want to diminish or disrespect that, but also to hold the space for the good of all as well, to take that space like America's right now like a polarized couple that's at war with each other, and the marriage is about to break down and head to divorce. And so one of the only things that works is you get a therapist who is skilled at holding the space between And that's part of what a peace builder needs to be right now, is to hold the space in our hearts where we can love and appreciate and respect the intrinsic worth of each individual, the equal ground of being that we're coming from. And then we can figure out how to navigate and what to do. And we can take political positions, but we do so from a place of more honoring and more respect. And if we haven't done that shadow work, it's going to tend to have some form of rejection of the other. So when we're rejecting the other, they often feel disrespected and not seen, and that will tend to inflame emotions more, and then we can lead into more and more spirals where things get higher. So to keep calm, it's like we have to do that shadow work and to see ourselves in the other and to be able to even if it's grudgingly, honor something that you can about the other. So I was at a dinner party a couple weekends ago, and people started to really trash Trump. And again, I'm not a Trump supporter. I don't believe that's the direction we need to go. But I do think it's important not just it's how we engage the political challenges that's important, not just the end result, because that ultimately helps up-level the result. So I said, you know, what? Let's go around. What could each of us at this table genuinely appreciate about Trump? And, you know, some people did it and some people weren't willing to do it, you know, honestly. But the exercise itself took us out of that polarized thinking where all we're doing is dwelling on what we don't like about somebody. It reminds me sometimes when Deva and I, my wife, have had challenges and we're really kind of like really at loggerheads with each other, we'll play the appreciation game and we'll say, all right, what can we appreciate about each other? And so it can be grudging because it starts to disarm us a little bit. So, well, I appreciate this. And you're like, and then you go back and forth and it keeps softening. And so you kind of you get beyond this like heavily defended state and you can start to open more, because nobody really wants to take in deep disrespect. And it actually, from a higher perspective, it's intelligent that we don't, because we don't want to have a part of our being guilted or shamed or diminished. We want to be honored for the sacred dignity at our core. And so if people aren't doing that, we'll tend to close the door to them. So if we're wanting to create peace, it's like we have to find that place where we can understand why people are supporting the candidates they are. We can respect that they have their needs and desires, and this is what they see as a solution for their needs and desires, and that we can find the place of appreciative inquiry where we can find something that we can create bridges with. And when we do all that inner work, it allows us to engage the outer world in a different way. And so just as an example with my book, Sacred America, Sacred World, I really wanted to have some high-level Republican endorsements. And I know that with the Peace Alliance, you're very much focused on having, you know, getting Democrats and Republicans on board legislation, because that's ultimately the easiest pathway forward when you can find this higher common ground. And so reached out and people said Rich Toffel, who is the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans, would be really key to be a perfect endorser. And so got the book to him. Enough people pestered him. They got him to read it. He said he really liked a lot of it, but that there was things that I had portrayed conservatives as that were sort of a caricature of people. And he just didn't think that I got it right. And so he was saying, I'm not going to endorse the book. But I said, hey, listen, let's get on the phone, and I really want to hear what you have to say. And so I really dug into his perspective, and I forced an inventory of, like, how was I thinking about things? How was I understanding the conservative worldview? And then I went back and I made revisions in several chapters and I sent them to him. I said, here, how does this sound and land? Am I going beyond caricature and honoring something more authentic and real? And he said, yeah. And he really felt like I'd heard his critiques and I'd taken him in. And I shifted. And as a result, he endorsed the book and we're looking at potentially doing some events together. So that's just like a really microcosm way. And the reason that's important is right now because everything's so charged that we need, like, if what we're putting out is ultimately polarizing around a candidate or a position rather than bringing us together, a lot of people don't want to touch it because it's like politics has gotten very toxic and very antagonistic. And so we've got to get to that place where the words that we're speaking, the how we're talking in our families, how we're actually even moving in our hearts, is to sort of find that place of dignity and respect and honoring the other And then we're entering into the conversation and building the bridges and doing the healing work that's required, because then we're not inflaming the separation and the divisions, but we're actually helping to bring them together.
That's great. That's really profound, Stephen. I'm glad you shared all of that in that way. And you know, it doesn't preclude us having our own values and our own desires and our own viewpoints, but it's a way to reach each other and really create healing. Mm-hmm. So it was very beautifully stated.
And there's another piece that I think is useful to think about. It was really helpful for me. When I was younger, I wrote a book called The Radical Spirit. And for me, it's like radical. I was like, I liked the edginess. I liked a little bit of the confrontational energy. And there was something about radical and, you know, progressive, and we're down with the old order and up with the new. And I realized that part of that was just not a very effective change strategy either, because I was, to a large extent, turning conservatives into the enemy that needed to be overcome. They were the problem that was holding us back. And instead, like, what I've learned now is that the different political positions hold different functions within the whole, and different people have almost a sacred role to play. And conservatives often are holding down the position in the collective of preserving the best of what we've created in the past, tend to be more focused on our history, deeper alignment with the core values and constitutional rights, and this is the way things have been, and we want to preserve that. And from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, nature can be very conservative, because if you change things too quickly, you can screw things up and actually send them down the tubes, and you can die, you can have problems. And so the impulse to preserve the best of what we've inherited is an important function to play in the society. It may not be my role, but if I can see that that's actually a helpful position in the society, that somebody's holding that pole, then I can understand, like, oh, they've got a particular predilection to their temperament that's leading them to hold this role, and I'm holding a different role. But ultimately, on the ultimate level, we're collaborators rather than competitors. We're actually both playing different functions within the larger evolution of society. And so that takes it out of some of the oppositional energy, because then you have to think about, like, what Gandhi did was he was really clear that in order to really liberate India, they needed to shift the consciousness of the British. They needed to open them to a higher possibility. And if you're relating to people with disrespect and dishonor without love in your heart, then they're going to tend to harden and entrench. So you actually have to engage the people that are holding the old structures in place with an honoring of them for that role, which actually opens the possibility for more evolution to happen. And so it was a really important shift. Like, for me, I think of it as removing a revolutionary energy, which is a little much, I'm going to shove these changes down your throat whether you like it or not, to an evolutionary energy where you're working together with everybody, including people who think very differently, because you recognize that everybody's holding slightly different positions in the larger whole.
That's a great distinction from revolutionary to evolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Well, I want to open up the space for, we've got lots of folks online that I think have a lot of questions and comments. So for any of you out there who want to join in on the conversation, if you're on the phone, you can push 1 on your keypad and we'll call on you. For those who are in the social webinar, I believe you can type in a question which I can read. I don't know that you can. Stephen, you guys use Maestro. I
normally would, but I don't have it up right now.
No, I know, but you guys use it, I think. Does it allow folks to type in a question, do you know? Apologies for not knowing, but we accidentally had it turned on tonight. There's a lot of folks on it.
It depends on what you have turned on. Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, no guarantees, but do raise your hand if you're on the phone, and you can try typing in a question. And I'll read it if it comes in to me. I've got a little panel here. So anything else, Stephen, before we ask to have folks jump in?
Yeah. Just maybe another little thing on the peace-building side. I think that one thing I really want to say is I feel that it's important for us as peace-builders to also move beyond having any polarization with people in the military or police forces, or to see them as fellow allies that are holding down a different part of the peace-building process, and that we need to come into more harmonization with them and working with them, because some of the best we did a peace conference in D.C. that was in partnership, and there was a lot of military experts and leaders, and they proved to be some of the most savvy thinkers about how do we do this. And so to really see some of those, I think that's one of the things where the peace movements of the 60s went awry, was that there was a heavy polarization against military and police forces, rather than recognizing that actually most people in those institutions, they want peace through the rule of law, through protecting from the real bad actors in the world. And so if we can raise the mission, one thing I talk about in the book is raising the mission of our country from the war on terror, which is essentially a negative mission that tends to perpetuate itself, to creating a world at peace. So then if our larger mission as a country is creating a world at peace, that includes the military, includes police elements, but it also includes the healers and psychologists and conflict transformation people and all of the great different kind of programs that you back legislation for. And so to erase that polarity and see that the peace building, real peace building, means also building bridges with within the military, police officers, and that it's kind of like an all-sector approach.
That's a great point. And for those who don't know, I think there's a number of new folks on tonight. The Peace Alliance, that we fully embrace that. We've had some great partners in the police community and in the military community who do believe in these values. It's the reason a lot of them get into this work. And so it's been very important for us to bring them on board to support legislation we're behind, because they have a uniquely important voice in the conversation. So it's critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're with you.
Amen.
We are with you. Yes. Well, good. Well, let me open it up here. Let's start with Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Welcome
Hi,
back.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for everything you said. It's really important, all the work you're doing. Touch on this a little bit, but maybe you would want to go into it a little bit more. You talked about doing the shadow work. So could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so as an example, I mean, the basic principle with individual healing is that whatever we keep in the shadows is always going to kind of weigh us down and bite us in the butt in some sort of way, that if we're in denial about a part of ourselves, then it's ultimately a barrier to us experiencing the next level of our growth and health and happiness and wholeness. And so the same principle applies to our collective psyche, which is in many ways sort of resembles an individual psyche. But so long as we haven't completed certain parts of our history and really faced different things that we have done that have been really destructive and dishonoring and terrible, it makes it very difficult for us to access our full wisdom potential now. And so I think what's happening with the racial divides right now really heating up is basically this is the unhealed shadow of slavery. We did not do sufficient deep work of clearing that from our collective psyche, of making apologies and making amends and doing the deep healing work, and you know, even looking at things like reparations, the way that Germany did coming out of 1945 Holocaust, they did the deep shadow work that it really took to come to terms and own what had been perpetrated and the repercussions of that. And I think out of that, they really emerged a more whole country. We've kind of drawn out our shadow work around slavery, and it just hasn't been completed in the way that we need to in order to move to the next level. And so it's erupting in different kinds of violence and misunderstanding and a lot of pain, but it's all basically a symptom that, like, listen, we have deep shadow work to do as a country around our history with slavery, and we need to do that, and we really need to make some of these larger shifts. But some of it is there's a kind of a almost a depressurization of the old that needs to happen. I was by happenstance ended up on Saturday night with just three other people, and it ended up being a half black and half white circle, and we ended up just speaking really deep truth to each other. And I felt like we cried, and there was a really profound healing energy in the room. And it reminded me that it doesn't necessarily mean being out in the streets. If we can be a deep listening and to be deeply receptive and to really hold that space of clearing, that's oftentimes can be just as valuable as an action. I'm not denigrating the action in the world, but in a way, there's the inner clearing and recognizing and healing, and sometimes that just means being seen and witnessed. And I, as a white man, like being able to see and witness and hold and appreciate somebody, African American, who's holding a lot of history. And that can be really quite a gift. You know, my wife Deva has worked in San Quentin prison, and she's had many people say to her, is like it's a primarily minority population, a lot of African American men, and a bunch of them have said, like, you know, I've never had a positive experience with a white woman before. And so it's just profoundly healing to have that. So there's a way in which, just even on a relational level, like we can help on a sort of micro level and on a macro level to help to depressurize the history, help to surface the reality of people with their face, and to work in partnership to shift that. So that's one area of deep shadow. We also have deep shadows around between masculine and the feminine, between men and women. That's needing to get outworked. We've had that with the indigenous populations. We've also had it with our various imperialistic tendencies, where we've gone in and capsized other economies and effectively enslaved them in debt, and something that people like John Perkins have really chronicled in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. So there's a bunch of areas that we need to do, and I think that a lot of our current challenges are symptoms of this shadow work, and that it begins on a personal level and ultimately scales up to a national level.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Stephen, but it sounded to me like, you know, when talking about our own personal shadow work, like when you were using the example of Sarah Palin, like where are the areas where we just have these dark thoughts and dark ideas and views that are, I don't know if dark is the right word, but things that are holding us down as something that people might think of as the shadow. So in our activism, if our hatred or our complete disdain is overriding certain areas, it may very well make us less effective and less able to really move more deeply into our activism and really build bridges and mm-hmm. create the change and the healing that's needed. So to look at it, you know, there's a lot of folks mm-hmm. who do, like, there's other terms than shadow, but I know there's a lot of folks who write books on shadow, and so if anybody who's interested who wants to learn more about that can certainly look up that term, Google it, and find out who's out there working on it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Do you want to get another question?
Thanks, Nancy. Let's see. Let's go to Hannah. Hi, Hannah. Welcome back on.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for everything you've shared. I just have a quick question. As far as mm-hmm. Dealing with politicians such as Trump, who don't want to hear anything about peace or even any form of agreements when it comes to certain countries such as Mexico, and you have all of this hatred and racism going around from not only him as a leader, but also from everybody that's following him, it makes it more difficult for anybody to try and open any kind of conversation or dialogue with him or his staff or his followers. And so you suggested getting to know them, getting to know him, as far as reading his books and understanding his background. Actually, I was already a fan of his, which is interesting, before he decided to launch his campaign. And that's when I realized, well, a little bit before he launched his campaign, I realized there's something wrong with this guy. I've never seen him share these kinds of comments, and I could kind of see a surfacing of racism. I don't know that it was there before or not, or if it's part of his campaign perhaps. So that was interesting for me to see, and because I was following him on social media, I could see a change from a normal business guy into somebody that's extremely racist and hateful. And, you know, right now everybody is either for him or against him, and I would say he's just as hated as Hillary Clinton is, but for different reasons because of his racism. So how do you go about opening any kind of conversation with conservatives that follow him and also with anybody supporting his campaign? especially if you're Hispanic, because I'm Mexican myself, so that makes it even more difficult for me.
I'm not saying that you should necessarily become a supporter. I think there's a very legitimate role for discernment about what serves, and I think that a lot of what he's doing isn't serving the evolution of America, unless we see it through a really wide-angle lens, that he's surfacing a lot of things that have been in the shadows and in the subconscious and haven't been spoken out loud. And because of the way he works with a crowd's energy, he may be basically eliciting a deeper level of racism and sexism than he may even feel, because that's where the energy of the crowd is stuck, that there's a kind of a, so I think of it almost like a repressed id that hasn't been expressed, and that the, quote, PC and all of the things that are more, have been very, created with a lot of good intention to evolve our society, ended up kind of putting a lid on festering resentments and racism and sexism. And so I think part of what's happening with Trump is that he's a showman, and he feeds off the audience. And so when he hits a nerve, that opens energy in the audience. And so oftentimes, if, like, for instance, when a comedian goes into a taboo zone, they're going to often get this eruption of laughter, because it's like, whoa, I can't believe he said that. So I think in the same way, because Trump has this desire to be in the spotlight, and he works the audience in like a showman, I think he is exaggerating things in a way that I don't think are quite as core to him. I mean, if you listen to his daughter, for instance, she seems very sincere in saying this man is not sexist, or this man is not racist. But in a way, he's almost like potentially, I think that from the widest angle lens, he may be surfacing a lot of this suppressed division and racism in a way that will eventually get voted down at the ballot box in a way that makes it it resolves it more. I mean, it may look worse for a while, but my hope and my intention is that there's a way in which it's almost purging a certain element out of the Republican Party, and that the hope is that we have a more enlightened Republican Party that emerges, that is fully committed to women's rights and fully committed to creating the space and love and embrace of Hispanic brothers and sisters, and same with all of real races and creeds. But it's almost like a purgative thing that's happening, and it can look really ugly, and it can have an effect downstream on kids and the society. But I think that's part of what's going on with him, and why you might have felt like you respected it and admired him before he came into this role, and that he's, in a way, it's like there's sort of almost a weird kind of catharsis going on. And I'm not saying that we have to approve that or condone that in any way, but for me, it's helped to understand a little bit more about what may be going on, and then to say that, you know, part of what we need to do is actually connect to a deeper place in people than the surface. Even if the Trump supporters are rabid and they're polarizing and they're it's like we have to find a bridge point into somehow reaching them in a very human way, and that can be just through, you know, finding out more about who they are, where they grew up, like moving it out of an ideological warfare into kind of the deeper roots of where somebody's coming from. It can sometimes be holding center and being like Gandhi's satyagraha trainees, where he had them practice and cultivate a very high level of spiritual evolution, so they could stand in the face of British oppression and nonviolently resist and create. And a lot of them would get clubbed, and they were harmed, and they kept the non-oppositional energy, the non-polarizing energy is maybe a better way to say it, in their hearts while they were challenging a fundamental injustice. And so it's an advanced practice, and I'm not saying you should, you know, go to a Trump rally and do this, like with the most aggressive supporter. I think we all have to bite off what we can chew and be honest about it. But there's probably people in your life, you know, Matthew, you were just in Texas. There's probably people in your life who are Trump supporters, and to practice with them is like, can this be a case where we bring love into a situation where there's mostly hatred or polarization coming out, or something that feels really kind of toxic, and to respect that sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, and that there's a certain amount of that almost needs to like off gas for the next evolution to happen, you know, and it's not always pretty, and there can be some really nasty tendencies and that somehow that that's also part of things moving to the next level, if we can hold the space. You know, I had a little bit of that last week. I was on Coast to Coast Radio, and I was sharing similar perspectives to what I've been sharing tonight, and I had a couple of very conservative people come on and just blast me at the end. They just went after me. And it wasn't easy, but I felt like part of the calling was to speak respectfully and, you know, even lovingly with them, even though they were, you know, really coming at me. And, you know, I think we have to respect our own capacity for that. We don't want to sort of, you know, we don't want to be masochists and take more than we can handle, but kind of keep upping our ability to stand in the face of some heat coming at us and not personalize it and not, we can do a little bit of energetic protection, and sometimes you might need to clear it out afterwards or have a reaction, but there's a way in which it's like a satyagraha principle to that, by continuing to hold that higher ground and still engaging people from that place, even while there's intensity and negativity coming off of them, that ultimately is contributing to the freeing of that energy and the evolution of our society. And it's an advanced practice, but I think the kind of people who are drawn to the Peace Alliance and on this call, you know, I think we're ready for at least some level of that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that. Thanks for asking the question, Hannah. Very good topic. We have a few minutes left. Let's go to one more person here. Deborah Walters. Deborah? Did you have a question, Deborah? Might have been an accidental hand raising. Let's try Vanessa. Hi, Vanessa. Do you have a question?
just a statement, I guess. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing that up, because I've never heard anyone else ever talk about it, and I've been kind of trying to practice it without really being able to explain it to anyone. So I appreciate very much that you were able to put it into words so well, and it might help me succeed in that endeavor. I'm in a small town in South Dakota, and I'm about to cry right now, but I won't. And it's my hometown, and it's just been kind of a challenge to explain to people why I'm doing this. And I just appreciate very much the validation and encouragement that came from, or that I feel from everything that you've been discussing.
Thank you. Thank you for your vulnerability. It's touching to feel that, and I can feel the nobility of how you're showing up and really trying to be a stand for evolving things. And I honor it. It's not easy. I mean, I don't want to pretend it's easy for me either. It's like last week when I kind of got slammed fairly hard on the coast to coast. You know, I crawled into bed and I told my wife, I'm like, hold me. You know, I was like, ouch, that hurt. And I felt like it's not, you know, we don't want to pretend to be superhuman, because we can take some hits in that process. And yet, you know, the more we're willing to do that, it's like, rather than react back or retreat away, but to just hold the space of love, even when somebody's off-gassing a lot of hatred and polarization, it is, it can ultimately be a real blessing. And it's important to remember, like, you know, in Buddhist lore, they talk about there was one disciple named Angulimal who was originally somebody who's called Angulimal because he had a necklace of 1,000 thumbs. He had killed like 1,000 people and had a mala of all of the thumbs of people that he had killed. And, you know, he was considered one of the most fearsome mass murderers of the day. And then the Buddha treated him with great respect and honor and love. And he made this turnaround and became one of the great disciples who then spread the word. So we have to hold the space for even the most hateful people to eventually become, you know, people who are really modeling love and enlightenment in the world. And not all of them are going to, at least in this lifetime, but, you know, but if we can hold that space, it's like that we're increasing the odds that some people are going to make that shift and really see themselves as, maybe I'll give one other example of somebody like that. Like, Joseph McCormick was somebody who was a Republican, I forget what they call them, but like kind of a hit person. They would do the background research on Democratic candidates and take them down in different ways. So it was like all kind of the black ops side of the Republican operation. And So he was like a real warrior, and he hated the left. He hated hippies and all this. And so, but then he burned out on this whole scene, and he ended up moving to the woods of North Carolina, and he ended up having some hippie neighbors. And after a while, he befriended them and started to realize he actually had something to learn from them. And out of all that, he ended up creating the Transpartisan Alliance. He was bringing together people like Al Gore and Grover Norquist, and really creating bridges between political parties. And so this is somebody who at one time had just, you know, specialized in some of the nastiest kind of takedown opposition research, and turned it around and became a real healer. So I think we have to hold in our consciousness the possibility of everybody that is engaging in that way of having that kind of a turnaround and eventually becoming, you know, perhaps some of our most significant allies.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and I've been trying that here, but the resistance is so strong, and it's just very challenging. And I kind of started it all within an abusive relationship, so it drew so many parallels, you know, between the big picture and the individual. And I just hope more people can start to see those connections and draw those parallels and realize what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I honor you for your work. And also be gentle with yourself. Don't take on more than you can handle as well, especially if you've got some trauma in your background that can be reactivated. It's like you've got to hold that tenderly, too, and respectfully.
Will do. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Vanessa. And, you know, one other resource, this is the Summer of Peace is in full force now. There's lots of great thought leaders and teachers who are speaking to many of these issues. Is there anything you want to share about that, Stephen, where folks can go to sign up?
Well, first I want to honor you, Matthew, because you were part of the initial birthing of a vision of a Summer of Peace. It's basically take the International Day of Peace and start to expand it out to create a whole Summer of Peace, and it's really blossomed in a lot of different ways. You can find it at summerofpeace.net, and there, you know, we've got a whole range of things from spiritual teachers to military leaders to, you know, academics on transforming violent conflict, and it really, you know, we've got a whole compassion mini summit, and we just feel blessed every year. We make it free for everybody. We don't even charge for the download packages. It's really our offering to humanity to help us evolve beyond violence and war and into really creating a planet at peace. And it's there's a lot of dimensions to it. So, you know, we created a World Peace Library that you can also find linked to there. And there's probably a few hundred different prominent peace builders from around the world who have all contributed. So, you know, it's our offering to the world and to all of us to find the inspiration and the methods that help us, you know, transform conflict. And some of the stuff that we do that you won't find elsewhere is also looking at the spiritual dimension. Some of the energetics, for instance, is like how do you work with attacking energies in a way that kind of, you know, doesn't take them in and kind of turns them around and does a keto on them. So I think that it's like looking at the subtle levels of how to be a peace builder and create change are also important too. So anyway, it's a great way also to just deepen your own inquiry. There was one woman I still remember who, fresh out of college, and she was driving across country to move to California, and she listened to the entire original Peace Week we did for the whole drive across the country. And at the end of that, she's like decided to devote her life to peace building work. And so just being in that field of inspiration with people who have really dedicated their lives to peace building, I think is so empowering for all of us, especially if you're in an area like you, was it Nicole in South Dakota that said that you're in a tougher area. And so yeah, I think it's good to make sure you're feeding yourself with inspiration as well if you're in a particularly hard situation.
Yeah. Well, it's just been inspiring, Stephen. So grateful for your time. Glad you're doing this work and out there being a thought leader and bringing this powerful message out. I've started reading Sacred America, Sacred World, and would highly recommend it to everybody listening. Share it around. It's a great gift. It's a great book, and you're doing just incredible work as always. So thank you for the
SacredAmerica.net. We got a bunch of extra bonuses when you buy one now at SacredAmerica.net.
Beautiful, beautiful. Any other parting words?
No, I would just say, maybe in parting, just a gratitude to all of you. I mean, for you to be on this call already means that you are being willing to be part of the leading edge of our culture and to not just accept the status quo where we have so much violence and polarization, but you want to heal, you want to bring us together, you want to created a better world. And so I just, a deep bow of gratitude to you for your commitment, your willingness to stand in sometimes in the fires and to be a visionary who's opening the pathway to a new world. So all of you who have joined us on this call deserve my bow of gratitude as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And on that note, I'm going to open up the lines and unmute everybody so we can all say good night together. So you're all alive. Good night.
Good night.
Be well.
Good night.
Thank you.